The problem of being overweight or obese is a complex one in the United States and increasingly in other countries too. There aren't too many one-size-fits-all solutions, but there are many, many people, including now the First Lady herself, Michelle Obama, with her Let's Move initiative that want to raise awareness and encircle effective interventions wherever and whenever they occur. We've got excess weight to contend with on this edition of WIHI, something most of us struggle with. And we're going to find out if we've got the proper will, ideas, and execution, to borrow a familiar phrase, to turn this situation around. I'm Madge Kaplan, IHI's Director of Communications and the host and producer of WIHI. This is our free audio talk show where we push the envelope to accelerate better health and patient care. I want to salute all of you who've joined the program today because obesity is one of these issues that is truly going to take a village, all of our smarts, to address. So a village. Luckily, that village continues to grow, and it includes experts in the field, new research, innovative organizations, and model strategies to draw upon. And today on WIHI, we're going to weigh the impact of some of those efforts thus far. All right, let me go ahead and introduce our guests. The National Initiative for Children's Healthcare Quality, or NICHQ, is one of those innovative organizations I alluded to before. They've been focusing on childhood obesity in the U.S. like a laser for several years, and we're fortunate to have NICHQ's president and CEO, Dr. Charles Homer, with us. Welcome, Charlie.
Are you? Welcome. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Also joining us from California is NICHQ's executive program director, Rochelle Merkin, who's overseeing many of their on-the-ground initiatives, including the Childhood Obesity Action Network, and we're going to learn more about that in just a few minutes. Welcome, Rochelle.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. And there's your picture. And it's my sincere honor to welcome Dr. David Kessler to the program. He's a familiar leader and steward of improving the nation's health from many different podiums, including as FDA commissioner from 1990 to 1997. Dr. Kessler is now based at the University of California, San Francisco. He has been thinking hard about the challenges we're facing when we engage with food, especially certain foods that seem to wreak havoc with our brain chemistry. Welcome, Dr. Kessler.
It's a pleasure.
All right, terrific. Now, there's more information about all the speakers on IHI.org, and I invite you to familiarize yourselves with all of their rich backgrounds in the work that they're up to right now. Now, one of the ways I like to kick off WIHI, sometimes I turn to chat right away, and sometimes I turn to my speakers, and here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to go around the horn, and I'm going to start with Dr. Kessler, and this way we might also be able to address people's levels a little bit. Some of you are coming in a little louder than others. What I'd like to do is ask you to do this. Looking out at, you know, the world we're in right now, you're all, you know, part of the news, perhaps contributing to the news, reading the news about obesity. What I'd love to do is say, Dr. Kessler and Charlie and Russia, you can think about this too. What's the good news? What's the maybe so-so news? And what's maybe a big question mark in your eyes right now in terms of the state of the state of what we're doing with obesity, especially here in the United States? Dr. Kessler, can I put you on the spot like that?
Absolutely. It's not a small task. Let me see if I could give you one perspective, and it's not one that I necessarily agree with, but I was on a panel with four of the leading diabetologists in the country, some pediatric, some adult. And we were looking at the data, the changes in obesity over the last three, 4 decades. We were looking at the trends. We discussed the fact that much of this behavior is conditioned and driven, meaning that it is certainly, you know, learned behavior that is highly motivated, that we've taken fat, sugar, and salt, we've put it on every corner, we've made it available 24/7, we're living in a food carnival. And my colleagues, every one of them agreed with the moderator, who was Nancy Snyderman, the NBC
right.
physician, who said, "We're toast as a country."
Mm.
It was not a very encouraging
right.
Message, but there was a real sense that with the environment being what it is, with our biology being what it is. Unless we dramatically change our relationship with food, including our environment, where we're heading is a real, potentially a real problem.
Okay. Toast. That's an interesting metaphor. I have to say I've thought about a lot of different ideas, including thinking about a lot of things that are going to be said today in terms of food for thought. And, you know, it's true. All the metaphors, in some sense, we'll try not to get into too much dark humor. But thank you. I appreciate it. Well, that's sobering. All right. Charlie, Dr. Homer, let's move to you. I mean, you're in the trenches. Here forever kind of with your colleagues trying to craft, interventions specifically directed at kids. So just a kind of brief headline, then we'll sort of get into more about what everybody is, what each of you is doing. But what's your sort of feeling about state of the state right now?
Well, I'll follow your charge, Madge. I think the good news is that we've got an unprecedented level of national attention on this topic from the most senior levels. And, you know, that's tremendous. It's unprecedented, something we hadn't seen for the past decade. And to be honest, I think the people at the top levels are very well informed, very thoughtful, understand that this is not purely or even primarily a matter of personal choice. So I think that's the really good news. I think the so-so news is the trajectory of the epidemic in child health, which is that the data show a leveling of the epidemic across most of the distribution of childhood weight. So I think that's so-so news. The good news is it's not going up still. Bad news is it's way too high, and certain populations, it's still not where it needs to be. The bad news is the one that Dr. Kessler exactly referenced, which is even with the leveling off with the current projections, I'll echo is we're toast from a healthcare health impact perspective. Unless there are dramatic changes.
Okay, thank you. Rochelle, what would you say to contribute to kind of good news, bad news, or maybe a question mark?
Sure. You know, when I talk to physicians and other healthcare professionals working in this area, there's been a feeling in the past of frustration with themselves, their own families, as well as with their patients. And I think the good news is that over the past 10 years, there have been additional studies and research that has shown that actually small steps can make some changes. Now, we have a long way to go in those changes, and I guess that gets into the kind of not-so-good news, because in order to make real change, we're going to need to change the environment. But I think that there's room for more optimism now than we might have had 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that's where there's an opportunity for real engagement and support. As Dr. Homer said, at that national level, we're seeing some interest. And I think that we're also seeing the research be more available and able to show us how we can actually make a difference.
Okay, thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Madge Kaplan. You're tuned to WIHI, and my guests are Rochelle Merkin, who you're just hearing, Charlie Homer from NICHCU, both of them, and Dr. David Kessler, former FDA commissioner and author of the book published last year, The End of Overeating, which I guess had some optimism in there. Dr. Kessler, let me come back to you. So given your breadth of knowledge about public health and science, it seems you could have written any number of books and on any number of topics. So I want to ask you, what prompted you to write this book about food, and particularly sugar, salt, and fat? And I suppose, you know, tell us kind of what the basic thesis is of this book. Thanks.
So the question, books are rarely linear. I mean, I was sitting in my office at Yale Medical School back about 7-8 years ago, and asked, you know, with a group of residents and fellows, and asked a, you know, very basic question. If you want to stay alive, what are the things you can do? What's the evidence base on prevention? And, you know, we just started pulling all the literature, and I noted that the librarian who was helping me at the time, this is before all text journals were, you know, really accessible,
right,
and she was I mean, she was working with me, and she was pulling all these articles on prevention. I noticed over a three-month period, she lost 30 pounds. Because if you look at the leading causes of death, cardiovascular disease, stroke, cancer, three-quarters of us are going to die of them. Weight really does influence and is probably one of the great contributors, to those. And then the question became, what is it that is so hard? I mean, if we just diet and exercise, we'd all do it. And I've struggled with weight in my life. I have suits in every size. And I wanted to understand the struggle. I wanted to understand why is it that I eat not only when I'm hungry, but when I'm not hungry? Okay. What is going on? What is that biology? And that was the journey for the last 7 years. And it did not lead me where, most of, our colleagues have gone. If you talk to people who've studied weight, the bariatricians, about metabolism, about endocrinology, this really, everywhere, as I started to dig, this is about being human. Right? This is how our brains are wired. I mean, we're all wired to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. For some people, it could be alcohol. Some people, it could be drugs, gambling, sex. But what's the most salient stimuli that is available in our society that is rewarding? And what are the changes over the last, three, four decades? And what have we done? And then we really have taking fat, sugar, and salt because they are reinforcing. Mm-hmm. Food is much more powerful than we realize. And when you start doing the neurobiology, I can show you on the functional MRIs how from, certainly millions of Americans, you cue them, you give them a signal, right? It could be the sight, it could be the taste, it could be the smell, it could be just the location. You cue them, just the anticipation of food sets off the amygdala. There's a response. It creates thoughts of wanting. There's that arousal. There's that momentary pleasure. And we get into, not everybody, but certainly for a very significant part of the population, we're highly sensitive to food cues. And what have we done environmentally? We've put food cues everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we'll probe this a little bit more. Thank you. Again, that book is called The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Dr. Homer, Charlie Homer, let me turn to you. Now, I know you're familiar with the book and a lot of different theory and analysis out there, and you and NICHCU are working away at trying to sort of package and formulate good interventions that the healthcare community in particular can implement. So when you think about what Dr. Kessler is talking about, which in some sense might even be closer to sort of thinking about how we get hooked on things and therefore how we can kind of get unhooked, how does that fit in at all to some of your own strategies?
I think they're quite complementary. So we have focused in two different areas. We've identified two critical roles that healthcare professionals and the healthcare system can play. The first is the role that we play in our day jobs and what most of us do for most of our work, which is we interact with patients. Families come to us, we provide counseling to them about what they can and should be doing. And the second is in our role as citizens where we have, and public health professionals where we have the opportunity to influence our communities. In that first role, again, our organization and I personally have focused on child health and in this area predominantly on the prevention of childhood obesity. We know that families come to the pediatrician, the family physician, the nurse practitioner seeking guidance. They have more encounters with us in the first couple of years of life than they will really at any time in their lives until they're elderly. And they're looking to us as sources of guidance. We also know, actually, that the way that we counsel, the way that physicians and most health professionals are taught about counseling, is extremely ineffective. We do things like say exercise more or eat less or give your kid healthy foods in ways that families are just not able to take advantage. So what we have been working on, and what I think is really quite complementary and not in contrast, not in conflict with what Dr. Kessler is talking about, is providing consistent messages to families about how they can help their children eat more healthy, eat more healthily, how they can promote healthy living, healthy eating and active living, how they can provide a health-promoting environment for their child within the context of an environment that is not health-promoting. And we do that by helping think through what their goals are for themselves and their children, help them think through how they make decisions, and really use quite simple messages. And the messages really are about the promotion of breastfeeding, for example, which is a critically important strategy, about not providing sugar-sweetened beverages, starting with juices, emphasizing the use of water. Those types of messages, and we try to use various mnemonics to help families remember.
I think it's very complimentary. Charlie, who's picking up on this? Where would you say you're getting the most traction in terms of either kinds of practices or, you know, I don't know, maybe we're going to move on in a sec to Rochelle talking a little bit more about the community. But where do you see kind of some real glimmers of hope in terms of how this what you're offering can actually be incorporated?
Well, the striking thing, and Rochelle pointed on this before, is many of us as health professionals feel helpless about this topic. But when you give just some very simple tools, some scripts about how you talk to families, to posters about what needs to be emphasized, we have found that this has been widely adopted, especially if you can help build systems into the practices. So we're finding community health centers are very eager and have taken this up rapidly. As you know, the Indian Health Service has embraced this kind of counseling. We have found practitioners across the spectrum, once we can overcome the fear of tackling this topic and the sense of helplessness that health professionals have about this and just give them some tools, we have found that the adoption of this has been far easier than many of the other areas we work with, like immunizations or asthma management, which really are much more complicated.
Do you see, one more quick question and then to Rochelle, do you see perhaps given some of the stuff that Dr. Kessler laid out, it kind of almost the ways in which many people might feel somewhat powerless to even sort of stop some of their own cravings or don't have a sense about what to do about this kind of condition-driven response as he's talking about the way our brains, do you see that there's kind of maybe sort of a role for a broader cross-section of the healthcare community to be thinking about this more in terms of some of the psychological dimensions?
Well, there is clearly, I mean, there's clearly a psychological component about this. We know that, for example, health professionals themselves who wrestle with weight have a hard time addressing this issue, don't necessarily recognize themselves as being overweight. So there are clearly enormous amount of psychological issues that tie into this.
Okay. Well, let's just keep going. And you know, we are sort of skipping through, I know, some very, very big topics, but we'll get to your questions and comments. Rochelle Merkin out on the West Coast, you've got sort of the community on your mind. And as I was reading what Health and Human Services and Michelle Obama with the Let's Move initiative, I mean, just everything, you know, was being thought of there in terms of the community, the food pyramid, the food industry. Is this a question of sort of coming at this from every imaginable angle here and, you know, beginning to see if we can sort of get the right group sort of all moving in the same direction?
Well, yeah, I mean, coming from that good news perspective, I think that there's now an opportunity and a realization that there isn't going to be one solution that's going to fix this problem. That we're going to be having to work across departments of transportation and agriculture and with industry in order to create solutions that are going to create sustainable changes. I think that as we continue to move this forward, the role of the healthcare professional becomes critical, not just within the clinic, but also beyond the clinic and into their communities. And the other arm of the work that we're initiating now is helping to train healthcare professionals to actually become advocates for community-based environmental changes. Because as, you know, we know that there are these small steps that can begin to make big differences, but there's also some very large systematic issues that are going to have to be addressed in order to begin to really make that those changes that are going to be needed for the longer term. So it's great that we can have family meals, and I think that, you know, what we see is that more families that do sit down to the table together and have ongoing family meals together tend to have lower overall BMIs, tend to do less overeating. But it's difficult when you turn that around and say, okay, then there's TV time when the kids in the household might be bombarded with advertisements around sugar-sweetened beverages and around their, you know, favorite cartoon character being plastered on the front of a cereal box. So we know that we have to address and tackle this issue on all these different levels in order to actually begin to make a difference. And we think that the voice of the physician and other healthcare professionals working in tandem with their communities, either with their school boards or with their local WIC programs or at the state and the federal level, to begin to look at how these bigger influences can help to make the changes that we need to level this trajectory that we've seen across the nation and within our communities around overweight and obesity.
Thanks, Rochelle. Again,
Madge, can I ask a question?
Oh, go for it, Dr. Kessler. Go ahead.
Take Oprah Winfrey for a second.
Okay.
Here's a woman who has unlimited resources, enormous success in her life, enormous supracortical control in everything she does, and she struggles mightily with her weight, right? And to the point where recently she doesn't even, she's not even tackling it. Right. I mean, she had Michael Pollan on about 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. right, which was great. But here, I mean, you know, I have, you know, I've gone to a number of professional degrees, right? I don't have a problem controlling any, you know, other aspect of my life. These are adults, right? We're adults, and we have great difficulty controlling our weight. Once a child becomes overweight or obese, right? I mean, do we have tools that really work that are going to work in kids? I guess from my colleagues on the program,
mm-hmm.
that really can add new learning on top of their old learning, that changes their conditioned and driven behavior. I mean, is the real hope here, you know, getting to kids before that learning gets laid down, so that they don't end up where food becomes, you know, this overwhelming stimulus in their environment.
So in some sense, it's asking, you know, a way to super prevention in a way before there's so much undoing of what happens. I mean, Charlie, let me let you go with that. I know I was reading some stuff about the various recommendations and, you know, this notion about, you know, reaching children, you know, paying attention to BMI and all these issues even before the age of 2, and the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force has sort of got more of a focus on starting at age 2. Do you want to address some of this? I know what Dr. Kessler is asking in a sense. It's a pretty profound way in which, you know, we've got an awful lot going on in our brains that maybe sort of works against even some of the best efforts. So he's kind of asking, you know, is the best hope here maybe trying to see if we can stop some of this getting in motion in the first place?
Well, I think I'd give the standard quality improvement answer, which is both and.
Okay.
So sure. Yeah. I mean, absolutely, we need to change the toxic environment that our kids are growing up in. And there's no other way to call it. It is a toxic environment. We need to change it. Meanwhile, there is data that suggests, so, there's no question about that. I also believe that, well, on the individual level, there are definitely challenges, and the Oprah Winfrey story is a great one. On the population level, we can make a difference by incremental activities as well. I think we want to focus on prevention. I think we want to focus on the environmental as well as the influencing the behaviors of individuals and families along the way, as we say. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations, I think, are telling. I mean, that, as everyone on this call knows, is a very conservative group that is very reluctant to recommend any preventive intervention. They said that there are, they specifically said, in part, because there are effective treatment programs for kids who are moderately, for kids who are overweight or obese, and those programs, by the way, in their view, are quite intensive, all physicians, all healthcare professionals should be monitoring BMI and identifying children at risk so that they could recommend appropriate intervention. They also said in the evidence report that there was, they felt the data were trending in the way that suggested less intensive interventions, the kinds of counseling were, the kinds of counseling that we're encouraging, is also likely to be effective, although not as effective as more intensive interventions. So, again, I don't think it's an either-or. I think if we're really going to change the population trend, we do need to affect the toxic environment, and better to affect that as early as possible. But I think there are other things we can be doing every day.
All right. Well, here's what I'd like to do. We've got a lot of different issues on the table. We have a wonderfully robust audience who've joined. We're going to go ahead and open up the chat for your questions and comments. I took a look at, at least as of a day ago, who had enrolled in this call. It's a lot of people working in the healthcare community, dietitians, people in public health. We welcome your thoughts here. I think, your ideas about where might there be a tipping point in your own community, in your own healthcare organization. I mean, we've got a lot of dimensions of this issue that are trying to be worked on right now, coming at it from different ways. And we'll get back to some of the sticking points in just a minute. Send your comments in so we can take a look at them. All right, here comes a few. Christy Powers, other than physical activity, are there pharmacological agents to increase metabolism rate? Well, we can sort of think on that. That's always something that everybody would love to speed up at a different time. Anyone want to take a stab at that? And one of the things I thought I would ask Dr. Kessler is people are sending in questions and comments. I'm curious to what kind of response you've actually gotten from healthcare providers, Dr. Kessler, who have taken a look at your book, your ideas, and sort of has it been embraced, met with resistance, a lot more questions?
Two very important questions. Let me take the the latter one first.
Yep.
I spoke to the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. These are the physicians who really specialize. These are not the surgeons. These are the medicine, family medicine, pediatric folks who really specialize in weight. And I was describing this conditioned hypereating. This struggle, this loss of control, this lack of satiation, this preoccupation with thinking about foods, those characteristics. And I said to them, what percentage of your patients, if I gave you those three characteristics, a hard time resisting your favorite foods, a lack of feeling full, a preoccupation, thinking about foods between meals, or if, there's that pizza box and there's only one slice left, you're sitting there with friends and you're saying, thinking to yourself, am I going to get that slice? What percentage of your patients, have those characteristics? What do you think they said? It was interesting. It's about 250 physicians.
Mm-hmm.
95% of their patients. That's more than we see.
Right.
When we do the epidemiology, we see some 50-60% of patients who are obese and in overweight. But for decades, we've been thinking about metabolism. Sure, I mean, you want a drug. I mean, I can, the fact is, you look at the drugs that worked, and the drugs that actually got the whole field into trouble, amphetamines work, speed
mm-hmm.
works,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, but they don't work on, the metabolism, they work on the central nervous system, they override the brain's reward circuitry, you're speeding, you're not interested in eating. And the problem with pharmacology is there's not going to be, when those who study the CNS, there are not specific circuits that apply just to food. The circuits that we're talking about are the learning, memory, habit, and motivational circuits. So you want a drug that works? I can provide it to you, but you're going to have to give me back some IQ points,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? Because there's not going to be anything that there's no magic bullet here.
Right, right. Okay, well, thanks. A lot of interesting comments here, people talking about, real food, which is clearly quite important. Question for NicheQ, maybe Rochelle here, they're talking about asking whether you are using the 5210 and motivational therapy in pediatric practice, and maybe you can explain for some of us, what is 5210?
Sure, I'm happy to.
Before
I do that, I wanted to actually go back to
go ahead.
Also the other point that Dr. Kessler was making about the real hope here. And I think for all the reasons that we've been talking about, that's why we've really chosen to focus on the kids, because I think that the kids are our real hope. The U.S. Preventive Service Task Force went down to the age of 6 years of age to begin to focus on kids 6 years and older. We are actually suggesting and recommending that clinicians start even earlier than that, and we start looking at the child care settings for as young as two-year-olds in order to begin to create more positive relationships around food, whole foods, as we like to say, and foods, that have ingredient labels that you can actually understand what those, it's kind of the Michael Pollan approach, what are the five ingredients, and
mm-hmm.
can you read all five ingredients, and do they make sense to you?
Uh-huh.
Because if they don't, then maybe we should be rethinking about that and what we're putting into our mouths. So again, I think the real hope is there, and I think it is with our kids, and I think it's up to us to be good role models.
Mm-hmm.
For those kids, while we're struggling on our own with all of the biochemical and all of the other environmental and other impacts that are coming at us.
Okay, Charles.
Now that said,
go ahead.
Should I go back to the BB210.
Yeah, sure, sure. Go ahead.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that is it, the what that acronym. Charlie alluded to it earlier. It's kind of a nice way that we package recommendations. NICHQ focuses on what we call the BB210 approach, which is breastfeeding recommendations, body mass index recommendations, so that BMI is collected on every child at every visit or at least one time a year, fewer than 2 hours of screen time, and no TV in rooms where children sleep, a recommendation of greater than 1 hour of physical activity each day,
okay,
and zero sugar sweetened beverages each day.
Okay, all right. So in terms of, we had some help here with some explanation from some others in the chat. Charles, there is a question, Charlie, about the power, though, or the influence of the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, at least in getting physicians to begin to ask questions and to be actually evaluating BMI and beginning to kind of really almost get a baseline with kids. Somebody is asking, won't that at least have that effect with doctors in terms of what doctors sometimes pay attention to? Charlie, you there? Did we lose Charlie? We might have lost Charlie. I don't know.
Let me try to take the question a little different direction.
Okay, go with it.
Slightly.
Okay.
The average two-year-old compensates for their eating. What do I mean by that? You give them more calories at lunch they'll eat fewer calories the rest of the day. There's a, the body has a regulatory mechanism, a homeostatic mechanism, and so they, these kids compensate at the age of two. If you look by the age of five, six, after they've been exposed to the American diet, a high percentage of them lose the ability to compensate. Right? So they don't self-regulate. You watch these kids, right? And it's as if they're constantly eating. You know, many of them. They don't experience hunger, right? Because they're just going from food to food to food throughout the day. I mean, if you look at, you know, we're talking, you know, the measurements, right, BMI, other measurements, you know, I mean, certainly are important, but a lot of this, I think we have to be careful. I mean, this is about behavior.
Yep.
Right? And if we focus too much on weight, right, I wonder whether the real issue, and you said it earlier, Madge, mm-hmm. I mean, you used the word real food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the problem, I think, I mean, is as much the food,
right.
If not more so, it's the food than the weight.
Right.
Right. You make these kids more self-conscious. You make these, that's the stuff of obsessions and compulsions. And,
right.
You know, I mean, and we got to change how America, you know, looks at food.
Right. Well, I think that there's no doubt that there's a kind of a frame here that you're bringing into the picture in a very, very strong way. And I think Andrew Guy says, agree, it is the food and not the weight. Bravo. And so I think that I think part of what we're trying to do is sort of come up with a comprehensive approach across a lot of different settings and people who are in a position to intervene who may maybe have come at this with not necessarily the entire comprehensive view. So I think that makes a very, very good point, and I suspect many of the people who are joining us are. And Charlie, are you back?
Did we get, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Sorry that we lost you there for a moment.
Terrific.
I think Dr. Kessler is sort of pushing on this point about food and cravings and, you know, whether or not, you know, we're sort of, I don't know, talking past each other in terms of interventions as far as focusing on BMI and weight and sort of using that in some sense as our triggers for intervention. And are we kind of going about this in a way that is even really taking in this other sort of whole behavioral dimension?
Well, I think Doc completely right in that what we don't want kids or families to be focusing on their weight. We want them to be focusing on health and health and wellness and what it takes to lead a good and healthy life. That entails certainly eating healthy food and being physically active. So, and that's what it's about, and we want to frame things positively. The word obesity is laden with all kinds of bad things. We healthcare professionals do have a tendency to focus on the negative. So I agree that we want to promote health, and that should be the focus of our efforts. Having said that, it is still nonetheless certainly helpful on a population basis to be monitoring BMI. And second, it is useful even on an individual basis as a mechanism for communication for the identification of issues. Families and even health professionals are very bad at identifying when there's an issue and when there's a problem. We have lots of denial mechanisms. Our physical just assessment isn't good. So, again, I think the emphasis is on health, but I still think monitoring BMI is a useful clinical tool as well as a population health tool.
Okay. Rochelle, go ahead, Charlie.
I want to go back to your the question that was posed about will the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force...
Oh, that's right. That's when we lost you. Okay, go ahead.
Make a difference.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is no one item, no one group is going to make a difference. I think everything together is starting to add up. So the U.S. Task Force recommendation is certainly helpful. HEDIS, the NCQA measurement that's used to assess health plan performance, includes whether BMI is monitored. We've already seen very dramatic increases from a year and a half ago when that first came out, when it was negligible amounts to much higher levels. Part of the First Lady's pitch is for all physicians to write a prescription basically around this issue and to be using BMI. So I think there'll be a variety of public strategies as well as measurement strategies that are going to be encouraging health professionals to use this, and they do need to use it wisely.
Charlie's point is just a very important point. He's made it twice, and I think we should emphasize, you know, the one thing we know, I mean, if we're going to have a fighting chance to deal with this public health problem, it's going to require a comprehensive solution. And I think that's one of the great things about the First Lady's effort. Right? There's not going to be one solution here. I mean, it really is going to require a major comprehensive effort that looks at all the tools in a very thorough way.
I think so. And I think that, I mean, part of what we're seeing is, you know, 100 flowers blooming here. And it sort of goes back to what we started at the outset of the show, which is to sort of see this rising chorus. And we're kind of coming at this from all sides. I want to just not lose you, Rochelle, in here. From the community perspective, where do you see kind of, you know, kind of what's the model here? I mean, interestingly enough, I'm seeing on chat here, a lot of people seem actually fairly optimistic. There's a lot of interesting ideas here, and I want to remind everybody you can download the chat at the end of the program, and we are keeping track of any resources that people are mentioning. We have a neat resource guide that we post to the archive page of each of our WHI programs. But, Rochelle, as far as kind of what seems to sort of be the kind of engine in the community right now, that you think is maybe, in some sense, going to start to show a way forward? Do you have a kind of a favorite community story you'd like to share?
Gosh, there are a few of them out there.
Yeah.
We have just phenomenal pockets of innovation that are beginning to evolve. I think a lot of people talk about the Somerville, Massachusetts.
Right.
Initiative that people may be aware of, a project that was started about 5 years ago where the whole community came together looking at really a multifactorial approach to creating a healthier community. And again, not really putting the emphasis on weight so much, but about creating health and health of the entire population.
Right.
They've shown some incredible results. We've also started to work in the south and southeastern part of the country where there isn't as much infrastructure, but we're seeing, you know, the same kind of energy that's coming up on the chat right now actually happening within the communities. Where we have so many different people and organizations interested in these concepts, there have been lots of different movements in different states at different levels to actually look at convening overarching obesity task forces and kind of multidisciplinary obesity task forces. So, for example, in North Carolina, at a state level, there was recently a group that was brought together to put together some recommendations that will now be used at the county level. And so for county-level implementation and hopefully for some budget decision-making and to think about how that might affect both decision-making at the local community level within schools, also making sure that we don't forget about work sites and that work sites are also engaged in this discussion, and as well as city planning, because we need to think about safe routes to schools, we need to think about sidewalks and streets that are appropriately lit. And then, of course, as we've been talking about for the majority of our conversation today, really about the food angle of it, so the access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and how do you incent local farmers markets and make it easier for all levels of the population to be able to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
Well, I think there's interesting comments about food. Some people are a little bit upset about sort of the imagery and the advertising throughout the Olympics. We've sort of associated great excellence in sports with Coca-Cola and McDonald's, and I guess that's the sort of larger frame that we're all up against. You know, Dr. Kessler, you mentioned earlier about speaking to bariatric surgeons, and I, I've been sort of trying to track some of the latest news and studies that have been coming out, and I just read an article about gastric bypass surgery for young people. It doesn't seem to be that the numbers are too large yet, but they are growing, particularly for teenagers. What are your thoughts about that? And, of course, you know, these are all sort of realities here. In some situations, it may indeed be warranted. I just wondered what your thoughts are about that in terms of it becoming, gaining some sort of a foothold in medicine.
You know, really an option, certainly when you're talking about teenagers and young adults. I mean, you know, just as an attending pediatrician, you know, on the adolescent service, you know, I view it as a tool of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
It is major surgery. Sure, it's you know, in some cases when you're dealing with, you know, regrettably, there's you know, not a better term, and you know, than but this morbid obesity. You know, when you're dealing with many of life's functions have been compromised. Have I been pushed into a corner to think about it? Yes, but it is really dramatic surgery. I mean, you're basically setting up aversive conditioning, and unless you change the way that person looks at food over the long run, they can override it. So it is the last tool that I would certainly want to have on my list.
Mm-hmm.
It is effective, no question, but it's very, very difficult surgery, and I don't mean the actual technical aspects. The care of these patients, I mean, is very, very complex.
Okay, well, thanks. I wanted to say also, in terms of just care here, I notice a lot of people being very, very worried, particularly with younger people, about with the focus and the outreach and the attempts to sort of wrap our arms around these issues with kids. How do we make sure that kids don't develop even further complex relationships to food, their bodies, not enjoying meals, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, the pleasure here. And I do think that's going to be one of the challenges going forward. Here's, I guess, the way I was thinking that we might sort of sail to the end of our program today. I mean, we're not out of time yet, but I guess what I'd love to do is thinking a bit about an audience here. You've got an audience here. There are about 500, at one point there were about 540, 560 actually on the call today. Clearly in this space of, you know, hungry, as it were, for a lot of this information, and are trying things, just as all of you, you know, my three guests on the call are today. What sorts of challenges would you like to issue to sort of those out there in these kind of pivotal places? They are maybe interacting with kids, they're pediatricians, they're nurses, they're dietitians, they've got, you know, they're you know, consuming a lot of the ideas out here as well. Is there some sort of message that you would want to send? And maybe, Rochelle, I'll start with you. Kind of almost like a challenge. At IHI, we often say, what can you do by next Tuesday? But I think that, you know, people are going to have to sort through an awful lot to begin to continue to figure out what are the best strategies. So what sort of a challenge, Rochelle, would you like to put forward?
Yeah, so the challenge that I put forward to myself every day that I guess I'd like to share with the group is really the challenge that the Surgeon General has put out for all of us, which come down to three main steps. The first one is for all of us to be role models. We have an opportunity to make healthy choices for ourselves and for our families, so as much as we can, that we can be good role models for doing that. The second piece is around the physical activity. You know, we haven't touched much on physical activity mm-hmm. today because we've been talking about the food part of the equation. But physical activity does play a role in this equation by allowing self-esteem for younger children and really a lot of secondary benefits that we can have a whole nother discussion around.
Mm-hmm.
But helping children and ourselves to be physically active every day through play and participation in sports. And then the third piece is around supporting children's healthy eating habits. So again, getting engaged with our communities and taking that on. So those are the three things that I challenge myself with every day, and I guess I would also challenge the audience to think about as well.
Okay, thank you, Rochelle. And I'm going to mention, just as a very, very quick thing, watch for a really intriguing new publication that's going to be coming out called Chop Chop. Sally Sampson, as she told me the other day, that nobody's talking about cooking anymore. And we do buy an awful lot of already prepared food, and I think this is going to be an interesting and beautiful, certainly a beautifully illustrated contribution to maybe ways, positive ways to engage with kids around food. All right, Charles Homer. Actually, let me do this with Dr. Kessler, because I know you have to run. Why don't we, what would be your challenge? I mean, you're seeing things in a pretty complex way right now. So what would be your challenge to the healthcare community and many of the people kind of working around these issues right now?
Let me just add two to the last three that were put on the table. One, I would ask that we be certainly. I mean, this is a it's happened to me. The more I study this, the more empathetic I become to people who do struggle, adults and in kids. And I think we have to change how we how we think about ourselves and people who do struggle with weight. It's something that's very, very real, and I think we bring certain biases, and I don't think those biases necessarily hold in light of the science. So I think we all have to become much more empathetic. Number two, I think this is not entirely, but certainly a lot of this has to do with social norms. And, you just mentioned it, the Olympics, the advertising, it's all the advertising. It's never about the food. It's always about the emotional appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And they know exactly, what circuits to associate food with. You'll love it. You'll want it. You'll have a good time. It's never about the nutritional value. We're going to have to change social norms. Someone said, and I think it's part true, Michael Pollan probably did more for nutrition in the last 30 years. I'm going to get into trouble with this than much, much of my colleagues in the nutrition community, because it really is about changing social norms. And I think that is the move toward real food, wanting things that are nourishing to put in our bodies, I think is a very, very important change that we need to evolve as a country toward.
Okay. Well, I can appreciate that. And if you do need to leave us to join another conversation at the top of the hour, I want to thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And Charlie Homer, I guess you're going to get the last word here in terms of challenge. And, we have a lot of I invite people again when you log off today. Please download the chat, because lots of good stuff in there. Charlie?
Well, I think the analogy to smoking is not perfect, but it's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So, for example, to build on the example of being role models, everyone on this call, I suspect, works in a healthcare institution. Their organizations should be as health-promoting related to obesity as they are these days about smoking. So they should only have healthy foods in their cafeterias. They should have regular availability of physical activity, et cetera. We should similarly push on the policy environment for changes such as the soda tax, and we should push for changes in our clinical encounters such that every single clinical encounter has appropriate, sensitively delivered messages that promote healthy living. That would be my challenge.
Okay. Well, Andrew Guy, or Andrew Guy, loved it. He said yes with many, many S's, Dr. Homer. So that got some applause on our chat. Listen, we do have a tendency on WIHI to we try and bite off some sort of big topics and see if we can leave each of you with some new ideas, new inspiration, and food for thought. And I want to thank Drs. David Kessler and Charles Homer for their time today, as well as Rochelle Merkin. And I want to thank all of you who joined the conversation today. I can tell you're all quite passionate about this issue, and I think we've got a lot of solutions and strategies that we're looking at. I invite you to check out NHQ's website for a lot more of their resources and tools that they are being put together. They're very, very tied into what's going on nationally and sort of new ideas and new initiatives. So I think that's a very, very good source. And again, Dr. Kessler's book, The End of Overeating. I want to also invite you to check out our website, because probably around this time tomorrow, you can get an audio download of this program. You can also find it on iTunes. You search under podcasts and the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. All our previous programs are on our archive page. Vicki Minden puts together a wonderful resource page that also gives you more links and things to follow through on, more articles than you can imagine, some of the most recent ones and abstracts and descriptions there that you can follow through in the journals. So I invite you to take a look at that on the archive page. Any questions whatsoever, you can email us at info@ihi.org. There is another WIHI coming up on March 4th, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Three of the leading voices in the United States right now on effective crisis management. That's when, and particularly when things don't go as planned with healthcare delivery, and you can count on that. Does your organization have a roadmap and a plan for helping everyone, and we mean everyone, through the crisis? You're going to find out what's on the minds these days and the plans of Jim Conway, Timothy McDonald, and Richard Boothman. March 4th, 2 to 3 p.m. That's on our website right now. You can enroll today if you'd like. The people who make WIHI possible. It is a long list today. Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Brittany McFean, Jay Rossner, Vicki Minden, Caitlin Carlson, Matt Morse, Adam Kirkpatrick, and also others. It has really been a wonderful team effort today. I hope you appreciated the music at the beginning, the music that opens and closes WIHI, original arrangements by Aaron Flanders and Miguel Sapasoa. It's my pleasure to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care, most of all, for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm Madge Kaplan. Good day, everyone. Thanks for joining. Mm-hmm.